Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Walter Isaacson is the best-selling biographer of creative geniuses such as Steve Jobs, Albert Einstein, and Benjamin Franklin. His new book is The Innovators: How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. It is a history that shows where creativity and science and technology intersect, what talents allowed certain creative inventors and entrepreneurs to turn their disruptive ideas into realities, what ingredients produced their creative leaps, why did some succeed and others fail. It's a great pleasure to welcome Walter Isaacson to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being here.
Hey, it's great to be with you. Thanks.
Always nice to have you on the program. Again, the name of the book is The Innovators: How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. Did this come out in some way from the Steve Jobs book?
Well, the Steve Jobs book helped shape it, but really for 15, 20 years, I've been gathering string on how the internet was created. I was in charge of digital media for Time magazine back in the old days in the early 90s. And I remember my boss asking me, well, you know, who owns the internet? And I thought, wow, that's a clueless question. And then, you know, he said, well, how did it get built? And I realized I didn't know the answer, but I was pretty lucky being a journalist. I got to meet people like Tim Berners-Lee and Vint Cerf and Mark Andreessen and Bob Kahn and Gordon Moore, the people who started Intel. And it was a way of sort of asking them, please tell me your story. And I was gathering that string. When I finally did the Steve Jobs book, he convinced me that the intersection of the internet with the personal computer had caused this revolution, and it was about a lot of unsung heroes we didn't know about. So I decided to do this narrative.
So let's just start with the word innovation, because you make the point that this word has become a buzzword and it's been drained of clear meaning. So you set out to define it. How do you wish it to be defined?
Well, I decided instead of just saying, here's seven secrets to innovation or trying to distill it, I said, let's look at real innovators. Let's pick the 15 most important things that have happened: the invention of the computer, transistor, internet, microchip, personal computer, Google, you know, pick 15 things and say, how did they come to pass and who invented them? And then you get real life people, people I'd never heard of, like J.C.R. Licklider, the guy who, you know, pulled together interactive computing and turned it into a network that eventually becomes the ARPANET and the internet. So these people aren't just sort of innovation in the abstract. They're flesh and blood human beings who have personalities, creativity. They're very different. It's not like there's only one way to be an innovator. A guy like Bob Noyce was the nicest person you could possibly meet. He was a mentor to Steve Jobs, who was a pretty strong and, you know, could be difficult leader, but they both had different ways of inspiring people. So that's why I wanted to do it by the tales of people instead of pretending that there was some magic formula to innovation.
You make a point in the book, and I think it's an interesting one, which is that creativity is a collaborative process. We often take one individual and look at their creative process, but in that idea of innovation, this is often a collaborative process, and that's something that you wanted to explore.
Yeah, even with Steve Jobs, when I asked him what his favorite product was, he was most proud of, I thought he'd say the original Mac or maybe the iPhone. Instead, he said, you know, products are hard to make, but what's really hard to make is a team that can collaborate and make products one after the other. So I'm most proud of creating Apple. And I realize that everybody in the digital age, you know, Bill Gates partnering with Paul Allen, Woz partnering with Steve Jobs, or Steve Jobs partnering with, you know, Tim Cook, that there are partnerships that then become teams, and that's the way real creativity happens. The only loner in the book is a guy, John Vincent Adonassoff, who pretty much worked alone in a basement at Iowa State trying to make a computer. He had some brilliant ideas, but he couldn't get the punch card burners to work and never really got it, you know, totally functioning. And that's because, unlike the people at the University of Pennsylvania who were doing it at the same time, the people at Penn had a whole team of mechanics and women who were great mathematical programmers and engineers. So it doesn't really help to have vision alone, because vision without execution is just hallucination.
And then, of course, there is the collaboration that takes place between contemporaries, and there's also that generational collaboration where somebody on Steve Jobs is building on the work of Alan Kay, who's building on the work of Doug Engelbart, and it goes down the line. One person sort of taking the baton.
There's a wonderful procession, starting with Ada Lovelace, where I begin the book, of people who can connect the arts to the sciences, people who connect our humanities to our technology. And that's a theme that gets handed down generation after generation. There's Alan Turing, and we'll be seeing him in a movie called The Imitation Game soon, who picks up on Ada Lovelace's ideas. So does Grace Hopper and Howard Aiken, who are building a machine at Harvard. They read about Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace, and they even find parts of that old machine as they build their new one. And then, in particular, there's a stream of people who really believe in making computers more personal and more intimate, and they build on one another, starting with Licklider, to a guy named Doug Engelbart, to Alan Kay, who's at Xerox PARC. Steve Jobs visits Xerox PARC and picks up the ideas for a graphical interface. You see that wonderful strand, and that's why I find history is so useful, because, you know, the best way to predict the future is to invent it, and the best way to invent it is to know where you're coming from.
I'm hoping you can tell us more about Ada Lovelace and why this starts with her.
She was Lord Byron's daughter, and Ada was also a mathematician because her mother was a mathematician. So she combines the poetry of Lord Byron with the mathematics her mother tutored her in, and she comes up with this notion of poetical science. It allows her to see the beauty in technology and how to connect humanities to technology. For example, she looked at the punch cards that were being used by the mechanical looms in industrial England in the 1830s to make beautiful patterns, and she realized those punch cards could be used on a numerical calculator, so it could do more than just numbers. It could do words and music and art. In other words, a general-purpose computer. And to me, that begins the line of people who say, don't just aim for artificial intelligence. Aim for a combination, a partnership of humans and their humanities with technology, and that's where you get the great innovation.
And when you look at that connection of the arts and the sciences, of the humanities to technology, you make the point that all of these innovators believe that beauty mattered.
You know, that was something I learned from Steve Jobs. If you want to distill the brilliance of Apple and Steve Jobs, it's beauty matters. A lot of people had made MP3 music players. I grew up with all sorts of ways to listen to music. And then Microsoft created something like the Zune, you know, which looks like it was built by, you know, in a basement in Kazakhstan, you know, by people who are half blind. But Steve Jobs creates the iPod, and it's just a thing of beauty. You want to fondle it. You want it next to your, you know, in your pocket. And so he showed how beauty matters.
And the other thing that you point out is that we give spaces, we create spaces for these innovators to work. There are collaborative spaces that help that creativity grow.
We thought in the digital age we could all sort of telecommute and do it by Skype and, you know, never have to get together because we could have virtual networks and virtual communities. But in the end, it's turned out people actually like getting together. In fact, being, you know, in a digital social networks, it sort of encourages people to meet in person and bounce ideas around off of each other. So whether it's Steve Jobs doing the Pixar headquarters or the new Apple headquarters and doing it in a way that just encourages people to circulate through a central courtyard or atrium, or Marissa Mayer coming to Yahoo and telling the people, quit telecommuting, creativity happens best in person. It all goes back to things like Bell Labs, where there were engineers and theorists and people who knew how to climb telephone poles, all working in this big old building with long corridors, bumping into each other and sharing ideas. We see that happening from Bell Labs to Intel to Apple to Google. Googleplex always beats Google Hangouts.
which is why you believe that even artificial intelligence has never been very fruitful, because there's always the need for the humanity to work with the machine.
Well, Ada Lovelace said that when you combine the creativity of the human mind with the processing power of a computer, you're going to augment both, amplify both. It'll be a great symbiosis or partnership. The other approach was, oh, let's just create robots and artificial intelligence that won't need us anymore. Well, you know, that sounded plausible. Alan Turing helped pursue that and start that field. But I just look at the history. I just look at the data points. And we're always talking about artificial intelligence, but it always seems to be 20, 30 years away, and it never actually gets closer than 20, 30 years away, whether you're talking about 1950 people said that or yesterday people said that. So, but you look at this notion of combining human creativity with computers, you get things like Google, which just sort of gathers all the human judgments made when people do web pages and turns that into a way to do search on the internet, or Wikipedia, or Apple Watch, you name it. We do better when we try to intimately combine us and our machines rather than build machines that don't need us.
Walter Isaacson is author of the new book, The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. It's published by Simon & Schuster. In talking about Ada Lovelace, you do point out in the book the important role that women had as the first programmers.
Yeah, I do think women have been unfairly written out of history a bit of technology, because Ada Lovelace writes and publishes the first real computer program when she's working with Charles Babbage in the 1830s and 40s. But you could jump forward a century later, and there's six brilliant women mathematicians who program ENIAC, which is really the first electronic general-purpose programmable computer, the one at the University of Pennsylvania. Likewise, Grace Hopper. I'm going to speak at Grace Hopper Day up at Harvard next month, because it's a birthday we celebrate now, but we didn't up until recently, even though she was a person who really pioneered programming, both of the Harvard machine, then UNIVAC and COBOL. So I think that it's useful, since we have a world of technology in which women sometimes don't feel comfortable. You know, the number of women majoring in computer science is only 17%, when it used to be up in the, 35% 20 years ago. So I think part of that is not having enough role models to know that, oh yeah, women are great at math, they're great at computer science, they're great at coding and being engineers.
So how hard is it to put your finger on the creation of the internet, not designed by a person, but designed by a team?
There was a wonderful team of people, mainly graduate students, because it got delegated to them to do the protocols for the original ARPANET, and then, of course, the Internet, when the ARPANET's woven into the Internet. And they do it through a process called request for comment, which is, instead of saying, here's how you should build your, interface between your host computer and the Internet, or here's how you do address headers on a packet, they said, here's an idea, but we're just doing it as a request for comment. It made everybody feel more collaborative, and it helped create an internet that's not run by a central authority, that doesn't have any major hubs that can be turned on or off, that's not dictated, the rules aren't dictated down, but the rules come from the community. And I think that's more than just a quirk of the internet. It really helps define the way we operate in a networked digital world.
And you also, you write about the Pentagon and Congress's input on this as well.
Well, it was funny. The people who were funding it in the Congress and the Pentagon, partly they wanted to survive a nuclear attack. They wanted to have a communication network that if the Soviets or the Russians bombed it, would still survive. And so they wanted a network that didn't have one central switching hub, but lots of decentralized things. The graduate students who designed it, many of them were like avoiding the Vietnam War, which is why they were in graduate school for so long. And they had no intention of doing it for the way the Pentagon said. So there was always this debate. I finally asked Stephen Lukasich, who was running the ARPA at the Pentagon, the place funding the ARPANET and then the Internet. And he said, yeah, Steve Crocker, the guy I mentioned, Steve Crocker didn't really know because he was on the bottom, I was on top. We were doing it to survive a nuclear attack. When I asked Steve Crocker, he said, you know, Steve Lukasich didn't really know. I was on the bottom and he was on top, so he didn't really know what was happening. So both are right.
And then in this whole going back to that idea of requests for comments, and that's when the leadership comes out, right? That's when we start to see these emerging leaders and the people who then say, okay, this is what we have. This is what we can do with it.
Yes, but it really wasn't some, you know, top-down authoritarian org chart, you know, or an organization chart where somebody reports to somebody. Even when they create the protocols that weave these networks together, you know, the ARPANET, the National Science Foundation Network, it's done by Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn, just sort of coming up with ideas. It's never, so I do think it's great to have that dictated way of doing things, that non-authoritarian way of doing things.
But when it comes to, again, going back to innovation, but also the key to this has been, and the success has been through leadership of creating great leaders who have been able to show us what is possible.
Yeah, and I do think that the mixture of visionary leaders and collaborative teams is the secret sauce to innovation. You need a person of great vision, like a Bob Noyce, and somebody who can execute like an Andy Grove. A person of vision like Steve Jobs, somebody can execute like Tim Cook. And the whole teams that they create around them. You look at AOL in the old days in the 1990s, had this wacky visionary, Bill von Meister was creating it. But eventually they have to bring in Jim Kinsey and Steve Case to get it running right. And if you don't have that execution, it's just hallucination, as I said. But of course, if you have a lot of execution but not much vision, it's kind of barren.
You also make the point in the book that all of this comes down to the fact that we as human beings are very social, and what we want to do is communicate with one another.
Yeah, I think the street finds its own uses for things. You know, as Aristotle said, man is a social animal. And so every time we've developed a new technology, we've used it to create social networks, to create emails and communications, hangouts, communities, and bulletin boards. And even when the web was created, it started off as a publishing medium, but people started blogging on it, and soon we have, you know, the mobile network, social network world we have today.
And you brought up Tim Cook a moment ago of I know the last time we spoke was about the Steve Jobs book. And so Tim Cook has been in this position for a while now. Is he an innovator?
Yes, because he's able to build teams. As I said, innovation comes not just from one visionary, but from a team. So he's got people, you know, from Johnny Ive, who understands industrial design better than anybody of our day and generation, as well as, you know, a lot of people who are making, you know, the Apple Watch. So I think it's important for him to always have a good team around him because, you know, he's not an industrial designer. He's, you know, somebody who knows how to execute. But I do think that the key to Tim Cook's success is that people trust him, people like him, people know that he's really good at running a company and that he can form the right team that has both vision and the ability to execute.
You also, in the subtitle of the book, talk about how a group of hackers, geniuses, and geeks created the digital revolution. These hackers played a large role in this.
Oh, yeah. It was a mixture of hackers and hippies who wanted to take power, you know, from the Pentagon and the corporations. And it was also wireheads and engineers and phone freakers and, of course, electronics people, you know, from the Pentagon. So it was a great mix of tribes.
The name of the book is The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. Walter Isaacson is the author. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Walter Isaacson, thank you very much for sharing with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very, very much. It's great to be back with you.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is The Innovators by Walter Isaacson. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.